Welcome to Political Rewind. For those of you listening in real time, it's Monday afternoon. Welcome to a brand new work week. We had an exciting start to the week, the two-way street team. We just spent over an hour talking to Tom Wolfe, the great American nonfiction writer, novelist, wrote about A Man in Full, the book about Atlanta.
Is this where you jump in and say, no, 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 boo-boo, and you didn't? Because I wasn't there.
No, we're just excited. We're going to feature him on a two-way street coming up. We're just kind of excited about it. That was Jim Galloway pouring water over my excitement. You know Jim Galloway. He's a lead political writer for the AJC, and he's in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. And if you go behind his brand new paywall, this is what Trump had in mind when he talked about the wall. It's a paywall.
we're struggling to find a way from Mexico to pay for it.
Politically, Georgia, State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, Democrat from DeKalb County. Mary Margaret, we're going to talk about some really significant issues today, but there is a lead question that we have to ask you. You have, since the last time we saw you, you've been in New York for the New Yorker Festival, but more important, you have now seen Hamilton. And
Hamilton. Beyond my high expectations.
Wow.
Listening to the music and watching it on television, you don't get the pace and the choreography and the costuming. The only characters in red were King George, the British soldiers, and the lady who seduced Hamilton. Everybody else has these wonderful muted. I just loved every single part of
it. Wow. All right. That's a theater critic, Mary Margaret Oliver. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Republican consultant strategist Chip Lake is back. It's been a few weeks. We're glad you're back here.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thank you for being here, Chip. And in a few minutes, we're expecting to be joined by Lori Johnson. She's a political science professor at Mercer University. She's down in our Macon bureau, the GPB Macon bureau. And as soon as we get that connection up and running, she's going to be joining us. Let's start, if we can, with this amazing Jimmy Carter interview, Jim, that Maureen Dowd, New York Times columnist, did not long ago. Carter just really, did he surprise you with anything he said? And if so, we'll go through a lot of the things he said.
Well, he said number one, that the press has been harder on Trump than anybody else. And factually, that's probably true. He is, this is a president who has shown more flaws than any other president. He also said that he doesn't think the Russian involvement was a directly impacted the election.
Rosalind didn't agree with him.
But let me throw this theory out here. Okay, all right. Two weeks ago, UGA professor emeritus, a fellow of Korean extraction, gave an interview to a major South Korean daily, saying he had talked to Jimmy Carter, and Jimmy Carter really wanted to visit North Korea. And it was printed in a Korean newspaper, okay, Korean language, okay. Now you've got Jimmy Carter going, having an interview with a representative of the largest and probably one of the most influential papers in the U.S., saying, oh, the Russian thing, not so much big deal. And isn't the press terrible about Donald Trump? This is a man who wants to go to North Korea. That's what this bargain, that's what this is all about.
Mary Margaret, you're nodding.
I believe Jimmy Carter, with a 70-year public service career and a Nobel Peace Prize, can say anything he wants to, and I will applaud him. I think I'm guessing he perceives that he could be useful, and I perceive that other presidents have not used him to his full capacity. He wants to be engaged at 93, and this, I believe he's sincere in saying this is a very dangerous situation, and he has a long studied understanding of the histories and the personalities, the grandfather of the current person who is causing us the most problems. Jimmy Carter should be involved. From my perspective, he could only help. And my guess is Secretary Tillotson would be happy to have him.
I was surprised at how light on Donald Trump he was and how tough on Barack Obama he was, specifically with respect to Middle East peace. I think he said he referring to Obama, made some very wonderful statements, in my opinion, when he first got in office, and then he reneged on that. And then further on in the interview, he goes to talk about the situation and his personal feelings toward the Confederate flag situation. And then he also
which aren't new.
They're not, and they're very well stated, and they're consistent. He's been consistent with it all along. And then he was asked a question about the controversy surrounding professional athletes and the national anthem, and he kind of came down on the position of Donald Trump there. So I hadn't thought until Jim said it that very well could might want to go to North Korea, and I think it could, there could be some possibilities.
And remember, he also said that he didn't vote for Hillary.
That's exactly.
Yeah,
right.
He was a Bernie. That isn't the first time I believe heard Carter say he voted for Bernie Sanders.
I think he said that in May, maybe.
Yeah, good. I didn't think I thought I'd. Lori Johnson is now with us from Macon. Lori, thank you for joining us. Sorry we had a little trouble reeling you in.
No problem.
Lori, you were talking, of course, about the Carter interview with Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. And one of the things we're going to kind of unpack, some of it went around about the things that people were struck by. So let's unpack some of them. His comments about North Korea, I thought, were fascinating because he does want to go to North Korea and intervene or to negotiate, rather. What's interesting about it, though, is unlike President Trump, Carter told Maureen Dowd that we overestimate China's influence on North Korea, particularly Kim Jong-un. And I think that he suggests that Kim Jong-un may have no relationship with China at all. But Jimmy Carter's last trip to North Korea to negotiate didn't go particularly well.
Well, and he went against the recommendation of the sitting president at the time. So, yeah, I mean, he's certainly shown himself willing to go against his own party and presidents from that party to do what he thinks is best. I do think he's genuinely concerned about North Korea. I think he thinks he can help. And there aren't a lot of people, as was being said, that have the level of experience and history that he has. But, you know, he also is a student enough of leadership to know the way to get something from President Trump is to flatter him. He'll use the same strategy in North Korea.
Well, I was about to jump in and say that that's exactly what I think we just saw. If you say that Kim Jong-un maybe is not under the full sway of China, you're saying that, wow, this is a stand-up guy who you need to deal with on his own.
On his own. That's exactly right.
And so I think, that's another little bit of bait held out there.
It was calculated. It was strategic. It was full of history and knowledge. And I applaud his independence against the former presidents. He's never been warm toward the Clintons, based on the Mariel Cuban incident from way back. I would like to see Jimmy Carter involved in the Korean issue, just as he's been involved in, I think, at least 40 other conflicts across the planet.
And Jimmy Carter, too. Jimmy Carter was a different president. This president is a different president. Jimmy Carter didn't leave the White House and jump on corporate boards and give all these speeches for hundreds of thousands of dollars. He did what he said he was going to do. He came back to Plains and he started the Carter Center, and he's been active in all kinds of philanthropy, mental health issues, et cetera, et cetera. So he, in many respects, he's against the mold. And I think that's partly why he can identify with this president. While he probably disagrees with them on a lot of the positions that he holds and a lot of policy that he has, I think, you know, they both are cut from a little bit different cloth than a lot of our traditional type presidents have been.
Turning Point is one of the books I recommend to everybody coming to Georgia. It was about Jimmy Carter's first election to the state Senate after Baker v. Carr. Jimmy Carter's always broken the mold. From day one, going to tech and to a nuclear sub to today, I applaud his service.
Lori, one of the things that interests me about this is, let's talk for a few minutes, and I'll start with you, if I may, about some of the similarities and differences between President Trump and Jimmy Carter. I think there are some awfully strong similarities in one sense. You know, Jim, you said that he may be right that no president has been treated by the media in a harsher way than Donald Trump. Maybe second would be Jimmy Carter. Much like Donald Trump, Carter came into Washington as an outsider, Lori. Hamilton Jordan, Jody Powell, all those key, Stu Eisenstadt, all those key insiders thumbed their noses at Congress. They thought they knew how to make things happen. And I do see similarities, Lori, between that and President Trump, don't you?
I do. The disdain for Congress would be something they have in common, although I think the root of it is somewhat different. I think for Carter, the principle and the intellectual arguments should be sufficient. He never really saw the need for the glad handing and the reciprocity that legislating requires. On the other hand, I think Donald Trump is good at that aspect of it, but doesn't always understand the principled objections or the intellectual basis of the policy positions well enough to manipulate around that. So, you know, they had their strengths and their weaknesses, which are not the same, but the outsider perspective, the distaste for some of the way that Washington works, and the desire to change that. They were both elected on change platforms to change the business as usual. So, yes, they have that in common. I tend to think of Jimmy Carter in some ways having more principles than he knows what to do with sometimes. And I think and President Trump may have too few, you know. I mean, well, they certainly have different ways of thinking about the principled understanding of leadership.
I will say that their appearances in Playboy magazine were far different from each other.
Well, yeah. Carter did come in, at least initially, with a moral authority that Donald Trump has never had. Now, it eroded over his 4 years. Yes, it did, in the sense that the moral authority was eclipsed by what many people saw as his very negative view about the direction the country was headed. The malaise, a term he never himself used, but was attached to him anyway, Mary Margaret?
I think Jimmy Carter is the true example of character matters. And, of course, he was elected following Watergate. And his character through age 93 and his habitat for, I mean, it's flawless. I think the word starchy that Maureen Dowd used sometimes is applicable, but his character is consistent. And I would go further and say Donald Trump's character is also consistent in the exact opposite extreme.
Yeah. Jimmy Carter got into the White House by promising that he would never tell a lie. The current occupant can't say that. I don't think so.
The other comment, Chip, that I was intrigued by is Maureen asked him about the... She apparently asked him what President Carter thought about Trump souring the image of the United States and the rest of the world. And the quote is, well, he might be escalating it, but I think that precedes Trump. Carter said, the United States has been the dominant character in the whole world, and now we're not anymore, and we're not going to be. Russia's coming back, and India and China are coming forward. What do we think about that?
Yeah, I kind of viewed that as an attack on Trump's predecessor, because he goes on to talk pretty shortly after that. I think the next question, or at least the sequencing in the article, was about Obama's position on the Middle East. And we all know that the position that the previous president had and President Carter had were divergent. So I was surprised. That was probably the comment that I was most surprised by, second to the fact that he did wade into the dispute and the ongoing protest of the national anthem. That was the one thing from that article, Bill, that kind of struck me. I thought that was a veiled shot at Barack Obama. And look, if he was trying to get the attention of the president, I think mission accomplished.
Again, a strategic comment.
Indeed.
Order to move his purpose forward of being helpful in the Korean instance.
Indeed.
Go ahead, Lori.
And the answer is a little bit different than the question. I mean, the question is about our image. The answer seems to be about our power and influence. And to me, that just seems accurate that we do, you know, it is not a one superpower global environment anymore. You have to deal with China, India, and Russia, too. And so, seems to me he's just being practical there about the reality.
I want to take up one more observation that President Carter made in talking to Maureen Dowd. I thought he was remarkably candid. Maybe he's only a guy who's no longer worrying about having to run for re-election and has reached a stage in life where he can, as you've said several times, Mary Margaret, he's got the moral authority to say what he wants. He asked about Confederate statues. Let me read the quote. And Lori, let me ask you to comment on this first. That's a hard one for me, Carter said. My great-grandfather was at Gettysburg on the southern side. His two brothers were with him in the Sumter Artillery. One of them was wounded, but none of them were killed. I never have looked on the carvings on Stone Mountain or the statues as being racist in their intent, but I can understand African-American aversions to them, and I sympathize with them, but I don't have any objection to them being labeled with explanatory labels or that sort of thing. I thought that was rather courageous, whatever, of him to even suggest that he found it was okay to have those Confederate memorials. Now, we put it in context, but he was pretty, he spoke out in a way that some people are afraid to right now.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead, Lori.
That's true. I actually have found myself making that distinction between the statues that honor the leaders, especially 50, you know, placed 50 years after the war, versus the memorials to the fallen dead. And the fact that typically we do remember fallen soldiers, whether they died on the right side or the wrong side, that there is something about the death of people that we honor, whether they lost or won. And I thought that was an important distinction to make. But you're right, not very many people are making it these days.
Right, and that one doesn't really apply to the carving on Stone Mountain. Carter was doing was kind of leaning into where historians right now are going, that you don't want to necessarily tear something down, but you can tell the true story of how it came to be.
I talked to Sheffield Hale, who's on the new commission,
president of the Historical Society,
and about this. He and I are church friends, and extensively about how the difficulty of sanitizing history. I'm of course involved in this issue from Decatur's perspective. Alina Perrin and I are having a press conference next week to introduce legislation we'll pre-file to return the authority to make these decisions from the state back to cities and counties.
Let's make sure people understand what you're saying. Right now, your friends in the legislature passed a statute which puts the power to deal with anything in any form regarding the Confederate tributes out there. It has to be done by the state, local.
No matter who owns it.
No matter who owns it.
And as you know, that was part of the compromise. I was not in the General Assembly during Roy Barnes' term, but that was part of the compromise that was made to bring down the flag. And so we understand that as a compromise today in 2017. We need to fix that now because my constituents in Decatur, Central DeKalb, wish to assert their own views.
All right, we're going to have to take a break right now. When we come back, let's take a look. On Friday, a short time before we went on the air, we got word about State Representative Betty Price's comments about quarantining people who are HIV positive. That's played out throughout the weekend. In fact, there's a development today. A very, very well-known Atlantan has weighed in on that. We'll get to that right after a break.
From Morning Edition and On Second Thought to Fresh Air and All Things Considered, listener support makes everything you hear on GPB possible. If we didn't hear from you during our recent fall fund drive, your contribution now can still make a difference. Please take just a couple of minutes to support the programs you rely on and enjoy on GPB at whatever level is right for you. Go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks so much for your support of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
We're back on Political Rewind. That was Mary Margaret Oliver that you just heard, State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, DeKalb County. Lori Johnson joins us from our studio in Macon. Jim Galloway and Chip Lake, also part of the conversation. Jim, on Friday, as we were going on the air, we saw this story that State Representative Betty Price suggested that perhaps we should quarantine people with AIDS, HIV, because this is a rampant problem, especially in Metro Atlanta. She's backtracking now.
Well, what she did was she asked the pointed question of whether the state law would allow you to quarantine people, and it was, as she explains it, she was trying to provoke a little bit of thought, and because the one of the big hurdles you have in this one little zip code where HIV is exploding is the lack of adherence to medical regimens that can be applied to individuals and to halt the spread of the disease.
Well, we're not suggesting that the alternative, though.
No. She's backtracked off that. She's, you know, in the same breath, she says, "I probably shouldn't say this," but then she went ahead and said that.
She said in a subsequent conversation, she was just being provocative. She says she's not in favor of a quarantine, but made the rhetorical statement because she was sad and troubled. Too many of our fellow citizens who have HIV are not compliant. Well, she's right about that, Mary Margaret.
The public health issue of AIDS in Atlanta is extreme, and she spoke from a position, I think, of some desperation about the avalanche of bad news on this issue. I've served with Betty, of course, at this time, and I serve with her on a committee that I respect her independence, and I respect the fact that she does a little bit more work than the average legislator. She shows up. She's thoughtful. She also was wrong, of course, on this issue. 30 years ago, when the AIDS Coalition came forward, there were issues of fright and fear and quarantine and those. That's a 30-year-old discussion. What is true is that we have a desperate set of facts about AIDS in the Atlanta area, and we need to do more. And she was wrong to bring up this issue, even if she intended it to be provocative.
Well, we should point out that Elton John, who, of course, lives in Atlanta, has now really come down on Betty Price. He's in Politico just a little while ago saying her comments were horrific, discriminatory, and astonishingly ill-informed. Lori, can you imagine if Tom Price were still HHS secretary and she had made these comments, what the fallout from that might have been?
Right. yes, they definitely seem to have their set of problems. To me, in some ways, it's about the power of language. You know, she was thinking of this as a doctor, as a health and medical issue. But the reality of the reason why people don't seek treatment or comply with treatment or disclose their status is because of the stigma and discrimination and prejudice. And so language like this just feeds right back into that.
Yeah.
It's not as if there weren't people who actually believed there should be quarantines back in the day. So it's just too intense of a language choice in the context, given the realities.
Yeah, and to kind of add on what Lori said, it is specific to language. When I saw the headline on Friday, the first thing I thought of, how in the world, in what context could have came about? Now, after knowing all the set of facts, after watching the video, after seeing her response, I think what happened was she just sat through 20 minutes of testimony from an individual from the Department of Community Health, specifically Georgia's HIV section of Community Health. And his testimony was about how we have a large population of people who don't get the medical care that they need. And as a result, this is a, quote, leading cause of an ongoing transmission. And so here you have State Representative Betty Price at a public hearing outside of the confines of session, certainly wasn't as careful as she needed to be in her choice of words, but, you know, says, and I don't want to say the word quarantine, but I guess I just did.
All right.
To me, it was like, what are we going to do about this? Instead of her coming out and saying, you know, we can't quarantine these people, so give me a solution. How are we going to deal with this problem?
All right. Let's put a period on this. Does anyone believe that this issue is it? Should we now lay this issue to rest? She made a comment on Friday. She apparently has taken it back and said it was taken out of context. Is this over with? Is that enough?
Well, I'm not sure that it was taken out of context.
Well, she said it was taken out of context.
It was badly said, but I think people will accept that was a mistake.
So, in other words, we don't need to discuss this anymore. It's over. The news cycle is complete on this story.
It is for me. What's not complete is what do we do that's positive and extend health care services to people who aren't like the people, the homeless population, like the Pine Street population and the issue of tuberculosis there, compliance is always an issue. Extending health care to those that are not thoughtful about health care is our job.
Lori, it's not probably at all fair of me to put you on the spot, but do you have any sense of where you got down in the Macon area, what you're dealing with down there?
Well, I know from the research I've read that the rural areas of Georgia are combating HIV at rates that they've never dealt with before either. It's not just an Atlanta problem, although it is magnified there because of the concentration of people. But, you know, Albany, Americus, Augusta, there are HIV issues in all of those places. If her saying that word is what gets us to talk about it,
good.
Okay, because we should not put the issue of HIV to bed. We weren't talking about it. We weren't having the conversation. If being provocative is what gets us talking about it, well, maybe that's what has to happen.
All right. Let's move on. Jim, I was surprised. Maybe you weren't. Maybe you know better than I on this. We'll talk for a moment about the governor's race. Stacey Abrams got the endorsement of a big, big union, the AFL-CIO, has already said she's their candidate for governor. It's October. The primary is not until May.
And Teamsters and IBEW.
Yeah,
if I'm not
right.
Mistaken.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's no. To answer your question, no. It wasn't a terrifically big surprise. It's the announcement was made early because if you really want to understand labor's clout in Georgia, it's in money and it's in door knocking. It isn't particularly in votes.
It's in money. It's definitely in money. And it's not surprising at all that they came out early for Stacey Abrams, who has obviously developed a national set of relationships that are extremely positive. It's also true that her main focus of her negative focus on Stacey Evans relates to the Amendment 1 vote where the unions were on the opposite sides and Stacey Evans upset folks with that vote.
Yeah, but it just struck me that it's awfully early for this. But I guess it tells us something about how fierce the competition is going to be.
First of all, you got to remember this is a May contest. So I mean, we're 9 months out now.
Okay.
Eight.
But by the way, what was Amendment 1? Is that was the fight over
the Constitutional Amendment, opportunity schools.
Okay, right. Thanks.
That lost.
Yes.
It strikes me, though, that the Democratic primary for governor is far more developed right now than the Republican primary for governor. And that might be because it's between two people, two Stacys. The Republican field's much bigger. There's a lot more that has to develop there. But as a Republican, I can tell you that we are very much looking forward to the battle that the Stacys are going to have. And, you know, we're usually the ones that end up having to put Humpty Dumpty back together after the primary.
Now
we might have some company.
Don't accuse me of naivete. I recognize that there are significant Democrats who've lined up with each of the candidates.
Right.
Mary Margaret Oliver has not, and before today's show is over, we expect for her to endorse a Democrat in the race.
I'm for Stacey.
Stacey. You know, you are about the eighth person in our studio
today.
Who said that.
Today, I'm sure.
Lori, do you see this contest as continuing to be a nail-biter? Do you think... What do you see it from the Middle Georgia perspective in terms of Stacey Evans' attempt to, in some ways, rebuild that kind of yellow dog Democrat coalition as opposed to Stacey Abrams, looking at African-American voters and a small percentage of white voters to put her over the top? What do you see down there?
Well, I'm afraid Chip may have the better answer on this one because my concern is that no Democrat's going to be able to win the governorship regardless. So all this attention on Stacey and Stacey just means dividing the party, the Democratic Party, in a way that will make it easier for whatever Republican gets the nomination to win. I mean, certainly I think the Democrats have to think about the demographics and you know, having a strong African-American female candidate, it's really hard to say no to that given the base of the Democratic Party in Georgia. I mean, I just think we all wish we didn't have to make a choice, but I think it's really hard to to reject that choice when we have had so few of those opportunities. But, you know, getting the endorsement of the AFL-CIO reminds me of someone saying, I own the tallest building in Macon. It's kind of like, well, it is Macon, you know. Unions in Georgia are, what, 4% of the workforce? Yeah. I mean, unions are not going to be the tipping point in this election.
Unions have gone from 7% to 4% of the workforce during my political career. It is the money. I think one of the, not the voter base, it's the money. But I believe one of the reasons that this race is so prominent right now and significant to Democrats and to Georgians, perhaps, is the quality of these two candidates. It's remarkable how skilled they are and what their resumes look like and what their political careers have brought them into to their young age. The Republican folks are going to try to heat up the negativity of this competition every second of every day until May. And the fact that it's two women is going to give them, in their view, that is sometimes, occasionally, not for everybody, but sometimes occasionally misogynistic, that's going to be one of the little clubs that they're going to bring out. Oh, two women fighting. The reality is you have two excellent candidates whose resumes are superior, if you look just on paper, to almost all of the Republican candidates, with the possible exception of Hunter Hill. I mean, I'm really impressed that we have this choice. And it's, from my view, given what happened at the Win List event and the conversation that was there 2 weeks ago.
Win List is the Stacey Abrams, Stacey Evans forum sponsored by the Georgia Win List, a Democratic organization encouraging Democratic women who are pro-choice to run for office.
Thank
just
you.
To put it in context.
Explain that. There was a first public appearance with the two of them together, moderated by Kathy Cox 2 weeks ago today. They, I think, had a very important and significant substantive debate without it being two women fighting
With
each other.
Lori just said that it's probably useless because there's no way a Democrat can win statewide, win the governorship at least.
If Donald Trump is elected president, we don't know what's going to happen.
Okay. All right.
I think she's got a point. We're in a new world here.
All right.
And we've got, you know, you've got two, at least two, maybe three candidates on the Republican side who want to be the next Donald Trump.
We sure do. And we will obviously be talking about the governor's race for a long time to come, months to come. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way, our second and final break of the show out of the way. When we come back, the mayoral candidates here in Atlanta debated at Channel 2 last night, and we're down to the last 2 weeks. Election Day is 2 weeks from tomorrow. We should talk a little bit about that. And we do probably have to at some point talk a bit about the ongoing, what seems to be an ongoing battle between President Trump and widow of one of the four servicemen killed in ambush in Niger. So let's get a break out of the way, and we'll be back with more of Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, new research about sleep, research that might keep you up at night. Matthew Walker, author of Why We Sleep, tells us why we need 8 hours, the alarming consequences of the lack of it, and what's going on in the brain when we sleep.
During some stages of sleep, the brain is up to 30% more active than when we're awake.
And he'll give us some tips on how to get a good night's rest. Join us.
Fresh Air, 3 o'clock this afternoon, here on GPB.
Get a good night's rest. Join us.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Let me reset the panel for you. Down in our Macon Bureau, we have Lori Johnson, professor of political science at Mercer University. And you're a lawyer, too, aren't you, Lori?
I am.
Woo. Okay. That's why you sound so smart. Mary Margaret Oliver, state representative from DeKalb County, is also an attorney. Chip Lake, political consultant for Republican candidates. Are you picking? Do you have candidates coming up for the 2018 cycle already? By the way?
I do indeed. I am. I'm helping Jeff Duncan in the lieutenant governor's race.
Okay.
Very happy about that. And then hopefully very soon, I could be playing a role in the governor's race. Although as of right now, that's to be developed.
All right.
Come soon.
All right. And Jim Galloway, who's not working for any candidate in the governor's race. But, of course, sometimes you're accused of it.
I'm accused of working
for it every now and then.
At some point, I'm accused of working for all of them. Yeah,
that's exactly right. I always used to say, Well, actually, it applies to this job, too, at Channel 2 when I was there. If I got phone calls from some people when I was off the air saying, you lousy liberal, and then others saying, you are so right-wing, I thought I was doing my job. You've been there, Jim.
I've been there.
All right. Jim, we're going to talk in a minute about the Channel 2 debate last night, because there were some interesting developments there. But before we do, Kasim Reed has been such a huge presence in this race, attacking Cesar Mitchell, supporting Keisha Lance Bottoms. And you had a column the other day that I thought was particularly interesting, and that's Kasim Reed's relationship to Peter Amon, who seems to be surging as a possible runoff candidate. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to one kind of insider-ish guy late last week who said that, you know, the internal polls are, you know, showing it to be a race between Mary Norwood in the lead with Keisha Lance Bottoms next, and maybe Peter Amon coming up. He's the former COO. He did work in the Shirley Franklin administration also, but he was COO under Kasim Reed for a couple of years. They had a decent relationship. I don't think they were all that close. They were amicable. But it was good enough so that when the Saxby Chambliss seat came open in 2014, Kasim Reed recommended that people start thinking about Peter Amon to run in that spot. He didn't, of course. And now he's running for governor. He's a consultant.
30 years, I think, with Bain, one of the most important consulting companies.
What happened was, I mean, he was in a conversation with one of our reporters, and he told what's a very familiar tale. You know, he says. He kind of compared it to the birds and the bees talk, that if you want to play in politics, you be nice to the guys. If you're nice to the guys with the money, they will be nice to you in return. And we put it in print, and of course that didn't go down well with the mayor's office. The mayor actually took it to a new level. Peter Amon never mentioned Kasim Reed's name. He never cast any aspersions on the mayor, but the mayor, a spokesman for the mayor, said that Amon was talking about Kasim Reed, and Reed considered it a personal attack.
Hmm. Okay. This dynamic, Mary Margaret, seems to be more and more common in the way in which the mayor is responding to other candidates, who in many cases are Cesar Mitchell. Suggested early on that perhaps with the contracting scandal that's going on, that perhaps major purchasing agreements ought to be suspended until after a new mayor is sworn in. I could imagine Kasim Reed took that personally. Nevertheless, the mayor's response was nuclear war. And this seems to be the way things are happening.
It seems to be his style for at least the last year plus, or maybe longer. I view him as a good mayor who just doesn't treat people very well and is overly sensitive. But the issues of corruption are front page right now. We can't ignore the issues of corruption. And Peter Amon has a long professional career demonstrating competence and, I believe, honesty. And it was fair for him to tell that story. To me, it was fair.
Is he your candidate?
He's not my candidate. My candidate is another long-term, competent, ethical person, Kathy Woolard. Okay. I'm for Kathy Woolard.
Okay. Lori, before we move into talking about how this debate went last night, what should we know about how you all in outside of the metro Atlanta area view this mayor's race? I mean, is it something that matters a great deal? Are we, when we have these conversations on this show, strictly talking to the audience that listens to us here in metro? What do you think?
Yes. Sorry, I have to break it to you. I mean, there's too many at this point. There's too many to keep track of. Once you narrow it down a little bit, then maybe you'll get some attention from the rest of us.
But
it's a little bit too much inside baseball at this stage.
Okay.
Yeah. And as somebody who has not closely followed this mayor's race as a Republican, but somebody who did watch the debate, that was
evident watching the first hour of the debate on Sunday night. You have eight people on a stage. It's very difficult to determine how you're going to take the first shot, who's going to take the first shot, who are they going to do it on. And all of a sudden, when the gloves come off, the final 30 minutes were fascinating to watch. But you have eight people on that stage who are getting who are registering in the polls and getting votes and have bases. That's tough. So I agree. I'm looking forward to this, to getting down to a two-person race and paying close attention in the runoff.
Yeah, it was the last 30 minutes were pretty good TV, I would say.
Really good TV.
You had Keisha Lance Bottoms accusing Vincent Fort of not paying his tax bills.
Vincent brought his visual aids with him.
Yeah, and Vincent pulled out his visual aids. Props were not allowed, but he didn't care. And he accused Keisha of neglecting her own water bills for a good while, which owned up to. And by the way, yes, Vincent Ford did have to sign a little piece of paper saying he doesn't owe any money. But I think, and Mary Margaret, you can tell me if I'm wrong, if you have worked out a deal with the IRS on a payment schedule, then that's allowable.
That's correct.
So here's what I think is fascinating about what we're all saying. Jim, you've obviously moderated some mayor forums. I've done two of them now. I'm actually doing one tomorrow night at Ahava Fahim, the synagogue at Peachtree Battle and Northside Drive, which may be interesting because the focus of it is social justice and civil rights issues. But I think there's something to what we're all basically saying, which is, and frankly, it makes you realize what a brilliant strategy Donald Trump employed during the presidential, the run-up to the Republican nomination, because it's very, you, as we watch these people at the mayor's contest, Jim, they're all, you're just talking, and you can't focus on them.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that comparison. That's a good comparison.
But it's true. I mean, Trump was able with 17, 18 candidates at one point to dominate, and there were sound bites that came out of the debates and confrontation all around what Donald Trump did. Mary Margaret, it's very hard at this stage, and I think these debates, as well-intentioned as they are, when you get 1 minute to respond to a significant question, and people like Jim and I have to play traffic cop, that's up. You can't talk anymore. Next person.
I don't think we have a Donald Trump in these eight people, but I do think the debates have served to weaken Mary Norwood. I think that there's a greater level of competency coming from other candidates. And her missteps are being televised and demonstrated at this point. Inside baseball again, perhaps, I just don't think she's a strong enough candidate to run this city. And there are strong candidates up there, my candidate, Kathy Willard, but there are other strong candidates. And I think the debates have had some benefit of weeding out her as the leader, substantively. Perhaps. We'll see.
All right. Lori, you'll be glad to know that there's only 2 weeks until election,
right.
And 2 weeks from Wednesday, we'll be down to two candidates, and perhaps the city of Atlanta will capture some of your interest. We'll have to have you back to tell us whether that's working.
I mean, we all want you to solve the traffic problems because we have to drive through Atlanta wherever we're going. So if traffic's on the agenda, we do care about that.
Let's move on to some national issues. Jim, you know, on Friday, we talked a little bit more about this awful fight going back and forth between President Trump, the call that he made to the deceased serviceman in the attack in Niger. And I was very inarticulate. I kept saying it's so sad, but that's what it is. Because this is not the way we ought to be fighting about a dead U.S. serviceman. But it seems it's continuing. It will not go away. This morning, the widow was on, I think, Good Morning America.
Right.
And this is just a bit of what she had to say.
The president said that he knew what he signed up for, but it hurts anyways. And I was... It made me cry because I was very angry at the tone of his voice and how he said it. Like he couldn't remember my husband's name. The only way he remembered my husband's name because he told me he had my husband report in front of him. And that's when he actually said, LaDavid. I heard him stumbling on trying to remember my husband's name. And that was hurting me the most because...
So that's Myshea Johnson talking about her deceased husband, LaDavid Johnson. Mary Margaret, you looked like you had a reaction to that.
She sounded very authentic to me. I had not heard that before you read it. The way she knew President Trump did not know her husband's name. Donald Trump showed us who he was when he attacked the Khan family. This is not the first time he has chosen to go after a Gold Star family. It is just beyond shocking to me. It's beyond shocking to me that he would think that's politically beneficial. It's not politically beneficial to him. His lack of ability to show any kind of interpersonal empathy, his lack of ability to understand that you have to know the gentleman's name before you call the widow is just, it's appalling. It's appalling. It's sad, but it's also horrible that he doesn't have that basic human skill.
All right, so that is a point of view. But do we believe that Congresswoman Felicia Wilson, who immediately after hearing the phone call decided to go after President Trump, wasn't she... Aren't both sides responsible for what's happening here?
Okay, you had Donald Trump and the soldier's widow as the principals in the conversation. You had one extra pair of ears in John Kelly, the chief of staff, listening in on one end of the conversation.
Yes.
And the congresswoman from Florida listening in on the other end of that conversation. So I don't think, that kind of equals out. I think... And if you listen to this whole the whole Good Morning America interview, I think what you heard was Donald Trump stepping into an already fraught situation, not just because the soldier was killed, but because his body was abandoned by his fellow soldiers and not collected for another 48 hours. You've got a widow there who is desperately trying to find out the facts about her husband's death and is not being told anything. And then you have Donald Trump call, and he's not the perfect shoulder to cry upon.
And there were a unique set of circumstances surrounding that call, too, and the fact that they were all in the car. The widow put the call on speaker so that everybody in the call could hear it. It's unique. John Kelly got up yesterday in the White House press room and said, "Look, I've made a recommendation to the president that he doesn't make those calls." What he didn't say, which I think he was probably thinking, was it's because I don't think he's got the proper empathy to make those phone calls. And the president tweeted out after this morning, after the clip you just played this morning, and said, "I had a very respectful conversation with the widow of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson and spoke his name from the beginning without hesitation." It certainly would have been nice if the president said, "I had a very respectful conversation with the widow of LaDavid Johnson. Her son is an American hero."
Lori, why couldn't – I mean, I personally think it would be nice if both sides – just decided to disarm over this. But why couldn't the president, after the initial phone call and the response, simply have said, "I am so sorry if I inadvertently said something which was hurtful"?
Right. I mean, I'm shaking my head as I listen to this. Why are those words so impossible? Who argues with a grieving widow? Nobody. If you know, whatever she's entitled to, whatever impression she had or didn't have, and you just say, "I'm so sorry for your loss." Repeat those words. "I'm so sorry for your loss." One more time. "I'm so sorry for your loss." That's all you need to say.
Yeah.
And so coming back to Mary Margaret's point, it shows this kind of fundamental unfitness for something that we've seen is an important understanding of our role as president, of the president, to be the mourner in chief, to be the supporter, the personal, representative of the government. He just doesn't do that role very well.
Anderson Cooper interviewed a beautiful young woman, a widow, last week, and he asked her, "How would you have responded if the president had said, your husband signed up for this. And she sounded so honest to me. She said it really depended on the day. My moods and my grief has been a total roller coaster. And Jim's comment about the context of this widow receiving the call, all the things about that were factually unknown about the death, is just so sad and so tragic that the President of the United States could not have offered that widow comfort.
Yeah, the other thing, Bill, I mean, there's a real issue here. Is you had Lindsey Graham on Meet the Press on Sunday saying he didn't know that the U.S. had 1,000 troops in Niger.
Niger, yeah, that was an astonishing comment.
So we have, I mean, the widow is not alone. We don't know.
All right. It's unfortunately, I keep using the word sad. This seems to not want to go away. It'd be awfully nice if it just would. And perhaps someone can help the president, whether he has the genuine empathy in him or not. I have no way of knowing, but certainly somebody can help him write the script that'll make it appear.
The reason it's not going to go away, Bill, is that we're going to have more soldiers killed.
Yeah. All right.
And John Kelly didn't seem to help. I mean, he started off seeming to help, but then he goes into the empty barrel attack on Representative Wilson, and you were like, why?
Yeah, that
How does that help?
Yeah, yeah. It would be interesting to, you could break that down and say that John Kelly perhaps really took a hit to his credibility, at least temporarily, over that.
He took, maybe, you're right, but he also, good Lord, the president used his son to prop up the president.
Okay, we are out of time, unfortunately, for today's show. Lori Johnson, thank you for joining us from Macon. We loved having you on. Come back sometime soon.
Sure.
Mary Margaret Oliver, can't wait to start talking to you about what you're going to do at the legislative session coming up. It's getting to be that time.
Amazon, what are we going to do?
Oh, that'll be fun. Chip Lake, thank you for
thank
being
you for
here. Jim Galloway, I love having you here, and you'll be back again on Friday, thank goodness.
Absolutely.
Friday show, by the way, Mark Roundtree is going to be here.
Ooh,
so
all right.
Talk more about perhaps some polling that he's doing. He's a Republican pollster. Andre Gillespie will be here. And Wednesday, we're reuniting Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson to talk politics. By the way, interesting note. At 10 o'clock this morning, we haven't talked a great deal lately about the devastation of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Turns out that Scarlett Johansson, Mark Ruffalo, and Robert Downey Jr., among others, are out shooting a picture, a Marvel Comics picture, in Gwinnett County. They're going to do a benefit, a reading of Our Town at the Fox Theater in early November, and it's all being raised money. It's money raised for Puerto Rico. So, yeah, good for them. All right. Thank you for being with us today for Political Rewind, and thank you to Olivia and Tom and to Tyler. Appreciate your work on today's show. We'll see y'all again at 2 o'clock on Wednesday.